Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S., designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hello and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I am joined by my co-host, Max Linsky.
How are you, guy? I'm excited for this week's episode. It's a classic Lammer topic.
I don't know what that means, but I did enjoy myself. I talked to Taylor Lorenz. She covers what she describes as internet culture. You might know it as the world of YouTube streamers, influencers, aka what is actually popular among young people in culture today. I have always really liked her reporting. It's very much from inside that world, not from the outside. And she knows about niches that I could not have even imagined.
The Lammer thing is that you like inexplicable internet things.
I do like inexplicable internet things. And I should note, when I did this interview with Taylor, which was not very long ago, she was a writer at The Atlantic. Today, completely randomly, we are going to post the show. She has accepted a job at the New York Times. We did not discuss that because I was unaware of it. But congratulations to her.
Well, this is sort of like a exit interview then.
It's she can send it to her boss at The Atlantic, who she had nothing but good things to say about. But she will be working for the styles section of the New York Times going forward.
I'll tell you who I have nothing but good things to say about.
MailChimp.
That's right. They're great people, and they do things like Read This Summer. Read This Summer is a program they've been doing for years now. We did it one summer. They pick someone to choose a group of journalists, a group of authors who have books out. They build a website for them. It's at readthissummer.com. This year, it's Jenna Wortham. It's her picks. And so if you're looking for something to read, go to readthissummer.com. There's an incredible list of books up there. And then the whole group will be together at the Decatur Book Festival Labor Day weekend in Atlanta. If you are around, or even if you're not, make your way there. Go say hi to Jenna and all those folks. And say hi to the MailChimp people, too.
And Evan Ratliff, who will be there. And I have heard rumors that Evan will be back in the studio next week. True or false?
True. Evan's long-awaited return is imminent.
Thanks to MailChimp. Thanks to Evan for coming home. Thanks to everyone.
And thanks to Taylor Lorenz. Here she is with Aaron.
Welcome, Taylor Lorenz.
Thank you for having me.
I met you probably like going on 10 years ago.
Almost. It's crazy that it's been that long. Ooh.
It's not really like actually all that interesting a story. We met at a weird do-it-yourself technology festival. I think we actually shared, people get annoyed and say that this show is all us having our friends on. But I do think we actually shared a cab home from that technology
festival. Yeah, because we got back really early in the morning.
Yes,
yeah,
that's
and
right.
You still live in Williamsburg? I lived in Williamsburg, and I think you lived around there.
I still do.
Yeah.
So tell me what brought you from there to now, where you're the expert, I would say. Oh. The online expert. What do you call the field that you cover?
I usually just tell people that I cover internet culture.
Yeah, okay.
Which is so broad, but it's kind of like that also means something different to everyone, so it's kind of hard to explain. But I write about influencers, meme culture, emergent behavior on different social apps. Like, very broadly, how I think of my beat is sort of how technology affects the way people communicate.
And the people that you cover are very young,
usually,
for the most part.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I would say 70% of the time I'm writing about, like, young people, meaning people under the age of 25. But it varies. Like, I don't know, somebody wrote something about me a while ago and was calling me, like, teen reporter. And it's not at all how I think of myself, I guess, because I always think of, like, or I notice some trend online, and often it's a teenager behind it because the internet is run by teenagers.
Yep.
But I don't know. I've written a lot of other stories about, like, older people, too.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that distinguishes it, there's a lot of, actually, people who've been on the show who write about the technology industry, who write about how social networks interact with democracy, all of these things. It feels like you write heavily within these cultures and in some ways are reacting to some of the outsider reportorial takes that maybe aren't quite as deep in that world and are more representing the viewpoint of a older person looking at youth culture. And I feel like I've consistently enjoyed in your work that it feels like you are debunking a certain amount of our assumptions about how young people live online and talking pretty directly with them about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. There is so much amazing technology coverage of people that really focus on, like, the darker areas of internet culture and,
yeah,
like, trolls and, you know, like you said, democracy in crisis, which is very serious and everyone should be covering that more. It's great. But I kind of actively avoid all of that. I'm very interested in sort of, like, online fame and fame in general and kind of how, you know, different tech platforms facilitate that. So I've covered influencer stuff since the beginning. And yeah.
I have a sneaking suspicion that those darker storylines are not actually distinct from some of that fame stuff. Like, a lot
totally.
Of the same,
it's all this, yeah,
the same levers are being pulled,
yeah,
just to different ends. And the techniques and tools and culture that creates, I think you wrote about the Christchurch manifesto.
Yeah.
That is both of that very dark world, and it's also of, like, game streamer,
yeah,
culture.
And I write about gaming stuff too sometimes. I guess that's true. And it's more just like the overtly political stuff is like, I don't know, because I wrote about, like, Gen Z QAnoners. It's more, I guess, like the younger angle of it and, mm-hmm, less like some very far removed writer that, like, doesn't understand, you know, who PewDiePie is, like, making commentary. I guess I don't know. I try to, like, be in the worlds that I cover a little bit more.
So was this something that was an ambition of yours? How did you end up doing this?
No. So when I met you, I was still doing social media for Verizon, I think.
I think so, yes.
Because we were at this conference. I basically went to that conference because, like, some of my friends from the internet were going, and I was like, sounds cool. It was the first year of XOXO, for people wondering. Anyway, they were like, it was like maybe 2011, I can't remember, but it was when everyone was bashing, like, social media managers and, like, how cringy are they?
Yeah.
And it's very, like it was full of these amazing indie creators. But it's funny because, like, I went back to XOXO last year, actually, since the first time. And it was amazing because I felt like all of those people that were, like, the internet creators at that time last year, it's like people that actually really harness these platforms and grow followings and have big followings. And it's just such a different, I don't know, people viewed it very differently in, like, 2011, but or 2012, I can't remember.
It's interesting, actually, thinking back on that and just the word creator. Like,
yeah,
I'm not even I think that conference might have been the first time where I just heard creator.
I wrote
a history creator.
Of the word creator and how it was developed.
And you wrote a history, yeah, of that. And I think that in your work, it's to simply be called a creator, which is sort of this blanket term that I guess covers everything from being, like, having a YouTube channel to, like, hacking drones,
yeah,
to I think, like, probably, like, people who start startups think of themselves as creators,
yeah,
now. It's broadened. And it strikes very differently if you're like, oh, you know, there's a word for this. Influencer is another one. These are words that really are within the last 10 years entering into our lexicon. And I would argue that a lot of people, if you just used the term creator or influencer in an article, would have no idea what you're talking
about. It was kind of a fight to get The Atlantic to let me use the word influencer in an article without defining it.
That would be, your job would be very hard if you couldn't use the word influencer ever.
Look at my early work on theatlantic.com. I used to have to define it. No shade to my editors. I get it. I mean, I think it's really valuable to be able to put stuff in context for readers that might not understand. And also, you know, there's value to being precise and explaining what you mean when you're, you know, when you say influencer, because everyone has a different kind of interpretation of it.
So you started as a social media manager. What did it mean to be a social media manager in 2011?
Back then, you could do whatever you wanted is what it meant. I worked in an ad agency called McGarry Bowen, which at the time was like Adweek Ad Age Agency of the Year that year. Like, it was like the very hot agency. And I basically got hired there because I had made some like popular Tumblrs that people followed. And
I have to ask, what were
they
these
were
Tumblrs
so stupid. I made an endless amount of them. I tried to categorize how many I had because I went back and was deleting a lot of them. Just because Tumblr, I was like, I need to privatize and get all these off the internet. It was like single serving Tumblrs, like every single thing I saw. Like, I would be like podcast studio Tumblr or something. It was all based on submissions. So I would start them and then like have people submit. So my two biggest ones were on bagels and sprinkles. And it was like bagels something, or I don't know, I can't remember the exact URL, but it was like some random. And then I would post pictures of bagels when I ate them. And then I had people submit bagels and I would reblog photos of bagels. And it sounds so stupid, but it's like I did this for everything that I looked at in the world. I mean, I made a new Tumblr like every week, and I was spending 16 hours a day on Tumblr.
What was your intention?
I loved
this?
Tumblr. I just thought it was fun and funny, and I wanted to see like how big I could get them. Like, I would try to see like, first, you know, could I get it to 500 followers? Could I get it to 1,000? Who could I get to reblog it? How far could I make it go? It was just kind of like a fun thing I was doing at my temp job.
What else? Yeah, I was going to say, what else were you doing
working bullshit jobs and like a call center and like at just like shit you do after you graduate college and you don't have a job. I was like registered with a lot of like temporary staffing agencies, you know, so they just send you out and you do
Those staffing agencies are still emailing me. Like, I'll occasionally get a weird like, do you want to come in and do Photoshop editing? I'm like, I have not been looking for a job like this since like 2007.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I'm still in your directory, and there's definitely not any way to get out of that directory once you're
one time it. I went to a staffing agency and they were like, we don't have any openings, but our receptionist just quit. Can you just go sit at the reception desk? And I was like, great. And I was a receptionist there for a couple months. It was all admin jobs, and so I had a lot of time to spend on Tumblr. And I mean, when this girl that I shared a cubicle with like introduced me to Tumblr, and it changed my life. Like, I wasn't really on the internet before then at all.
What were you like? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Connecticut, in Greenwich, Connecticut. I went to this kind of small Swiss boarding school, and then I went to University of Colorado for college. I kind of just, this is so lame, but I was obsessed with being popular, and I thought the internet was for like losers. So I had like AIM.
You were right.
I had Facebook and I'm so mad now, but I like love the internet now. I was like, why was I like not online more? I was too busy like just, I don't know, hanging out at the mall or something. But I had Facebook in college, but I wasn't really like involved in it. And I just, it wasn't until I got on Tumblr that I was like, oh my God, this is my life now.
Well, it's not so strange to me that I don't know what you mean by being popular, but what you're interested in is often in people who have this sort of unquenchable thirst for popularity and fame, and people who've almost abstracted the idea of being like a creator or art into basically like a pure viral understanding of themselves as a popular figure. What interests you about that, and what have you learned about it in writing about it?
Yeah, I would say I'm really interested in like social dynamics, I guess. Like, I guess what I mean by that is like, I was always really shy when I was younger, and I kind of like wanted to be cool, but I wasn't ever cool. I mean, I was cool in like the nerdy kid cool way, but like not cool, cool, but also not nerdy enough to like be on the internet. So yeah. I don't know. It was this like weird thing. And I just was really interested in social dynamics. I remember when everyone got on Webshots. Did you ever remember Webshots?
I don't know.
It was Webshots. Gone. It was like an early Flickr. It was like before Flickr, but all these girls in high school put their stuff on Webshots. And I just remember you could see like who was in everyone's web shots. And I was just really interested in that because some girls got like a lot of attention on it. It was a weird system. But like, I don't know. So I've always been interested in kind of like how people present themselves online and how technology affects how people connect. It wasn't that I got really interested in like online fame, I would say, until Tumblr, because I had achieved like some modicum of it, I guess. Like people in the Tumblr community, some of them knew who I was. And, like, I went to a couple Tumblr meetups in, like, 2009, 2010, and, like, you know, there'd be, like, people that ran popular Tumblrs, and it just got me interested in, like, how it all worked, I guess. I didn't ever want to be that myself, though. It was more, like, I was just more interested in the mechanics of it, like, how the platform treated certain tweets and, like, how you could get in a trending topic or something, more than, like, oh, let me be a YouTuber or something with my face in front of it.
So you started as a social media manager. Yeah. Which is like sort of on the opposite side of the equation from being a reporter, but is not like totally dissimilar.
Yeah, it was. I mean, so those days it was great to be a social media person because like you could do, there was not really analytics on the internet yet. And also any brand just like wanted to say that they had like a Tumblr or a Facebook page or a Twitter. So there was almost no oversight. Like I would post things on the Bud Light Facebook page and like the client would sort of approve them, but basically not really care. Like now it's so like there's just so much feedback and, you know, that's it's a whole system. And there wasn't as much money floating around anyway. So I did. Yeah, I was in advertising. And it wasn't until sort of 2012, I think it was, that I left McGarry Bowen because I got this job at the Daily Mail. The Daily Mail at that time didn't even have like they barely had share buttons on the website. They didn't really until end of 2012. And then they didn't have a Facebook page, really. They didn't have like a active Twitter account. So I kind of pitched the idea to them of like joining. Like they wanted to hire somebody to set those things up, I think, because the editor there was like, we need someone. And I was like, let me do it. And let me just take over everything in the whole company and your whole global system. So I started all of that for them and then hired a team of like 11 people and was like, I mean, I was like really young person in senior management there.
Daily Mail is like one of the biggest. It's the biggest newspaper
it is the biggest,
in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, this will be a good piece of history when people listen to this like in 20 years. Like the biggest newspaper in the world is less than 10 years into doing social media at all.
What I did for that company, not to like toot my own horn, but like what I did for that company was crazy and insane. And I am like the reason I sound so arrogant, but like I fucking worked my ass off and like I built that company's social presence. And like, so props to me. I spread a lot of celebrity news all over the internet. But I mean, so did all the amazing people that I worked with, too. But it was a great brand because it's like a tabloid and it's like very kind of questionably accurate sometimes. And anyways, it was a good brand to kind of start social for.
Did you start having like ambitions to write while you were doing that?
No. I never wrote. So I always like, I basically worked in social strategy. After I left the Daily Mail, I was getting really burned out. So I just like went to a consulting role with them. And then started doing strategy for other media organizations. So I was like at Mental Floss as their like director of partnerships or something, sort of running social campaigns for them. I did a bunch of other like branded work for like clients like Adobe and tech companies and stuff. And then around that time, I was really interested in this idea of like online fame. And so I pitched this idea. I thought about starting my own media company, but I didn't want to do that. But I basically was like, maybe I'll just get somebody else to pay me to do this. So I like went to Time Inc. and basically they helped me. I helped start this sub-brand within People magazine that was solely dedicated to covering influencers and online creators. And I did more reporting for that. Like I would interview these YouTube stars and I would like, I handled all the editorial strategy for that launch and it kind of just got me like, maybe I should cover stuff, but I didn't think I was a good enough writer to ever be a reporter. So anyway, after that, I didn't want to move to LA for that job to do it any longer. And I got this opportunity to work for Nitzan Zimmerman, who Used to be a gawker for a long time, but he was like a viral, like if you Google his name, he's like very viral.
I'm just going to keep filling in the, for the history books. So Gawker at the time was public with its traffic. Maybe it still is actually, different ownership. So you could see how many clicks each writer drove each month. And I don't remember the exact percentage, but for a period of time, Nitzan Zimmerman was driving like half of the traffic to
like
Gawker.
He was responsible for like almost all the traffic.
So he's just, I should have him on the show because I don't know how he was given this gift and curse, but he had just sort of cracked personally like what would go viral on Gawker. And it came to a point, as I recall, where like he became almost vital and it became like a big problem when he eventually left because he was more than half of the traffic that came every month. And I don't really remember like what it was he was posting. I think what he was posting would now just be known as sort of viral clickbaity content, but at the time was radical and its viral clickbaitiness.
He's really good at story framing. So he also founded this Tumblr called The Daily What. I kind of knew him from that. He's done a lot of cool stuff with internet. He worked at Cheeseburger. So basically, he got hired at The Hill, which is a political news site, to kind of like revamp their social stuff, and offered me a job. And I was like, great, I'll do it. I've never covered an election, whatever. So I worked for him for 2 years at The Hill working on social stuff. Nitzan is the best editor I've ever worked with in my life in terms of like headlines and story framing. Like he will take something. I mean, truly the only person I've ever met that ever rivals him is the editor-in-chief of the Daily Mail, who's like a genius, who should actually be credited with all their success because he is a genius. But I think like what Nitzan does so well is like he'll take a boring local news story or he'll like spot a boring news story that isn't picked up yet and like frame it in a different way and make it blow up. But like it's clickbaity, but it's not. Like he's also just very good at pulling out quotes, very good at like understanding what people will share and read. So
I mean, there's a similarity between that and your work in that you're not like doing like an investigation that like reveals something we never knew about these people. Like most of the information that you're reporting on, it's like pretty well out there on the internet. But if you did not personally frame it for me, I would neither know it existed nor know that it would be something that would interest me. And it usually actually does interest me because honestly, for me, like this whole world of influencers and YouTube creators is totally foreign. Like I feel like it's like a secret world I don't know that exists, but I understand that you can't just be like, hey, there's a secret world. You should come and check it out. You have to give people some steps along the way. So like now you're working for The Atlantic, which is not maybe as virally traffic driven as the Daily Mail. Like, what have you learned about framing these stories and what goes into your mind when you're thinking of one of these stories? What are the different packages and formats and what are the important parts? Yeah. What are the important boxes that it checks?
I guess when I think of a story, I always have like too many stories. So I'm usually like, oh, like it's a more prioritizing thing, but it's, I don't know how to explain it because it's like somebody will tell me something and I'm like, oh, that's a story. Or like, oh, that's just something that people would share. I would say with The Atlantic, like even though the framing, they might not end up putting that like sensational headline on it, I think that sensational headline in my head.
You're just like whispering it under
your breath. Like for instance, I wrote a story this week on this influencer, this like exclusive influencer party that the Instagram throws on this beach by Malibu and whatever. And in my mind, I'll think of a headline like inside the elite exclusive influencer party that Instagram throws for like 500 top creators. Like that's the headline that I would put on it, right? If I worked at Daily Mail. Still, The Atlantic, I think the headline was like, where everyone's an influencer or something. Like, so it's like toned down, but the story is still that like angle of a like juicy kind of fun story, I guess. So like I do that with all my stories where I think of like, okay, what's like the tabloid headline on it, I guess you could say. And usually the headline that some place will put on it is different or, you know, whatever. We test headlines too, but that's like how I think of it, I guess. I don't do stories that other people wrote. So like, I don't like to, unless I have a take on it. Like, I don't, thankfully, because of The Atlantic, like, it's not like I'm doing breaking news all the time. So I get to focus on stories that I'm more interested in, too. So it's like kind of just, sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm really interested in Discord, for instance, which is this like app. Like, you know, what can I write about that? Or like, what's something interesting that's going on there?
How much do you feel like you need to explain something like Discord to The Atlantic's audience? Like, to what degree of literacy do you expect people in the subjects that you're going over?
It's really important to be accessible. Like, I always wanted to write for a mainstream audience. I didn't want to be a reporter just for people that care about this stuff already. I think because I felt like the stuff that I was covering was important and needed more people covering it and, like, needed to be validated. And so because I want to write for a mainstream audience, I sort of assume that people don't know what's going on, or, like, don't maybe – I think they should know what an influencer is by now, hopefully, but or have heard the word. But, like, I definitely – don't try to be, like, too insidery. Like, you want to write in a way so that people who get it, like, know that you're not an actual idiot, but, like, people who don't get it also don't feel left out.
Yeah, I think that is, like, an essential tension. And when I read your work, even though I kind of, each article does break these things down, I think you're telling kind of an overall story also. Like, how do you think about covering, for lack of a better word, micro trends within what you're doing? Like, you wrote recently about how people are dropping the Instagram manicured lit aesthetic for sort of a, like, raw, more like personal, here is me with warts and all kind of thing, which is a subjective idea, but it also, like, there's also, like, billions of dollars at stake. And these are the kind of things that people, like, pay consultants to tell them in boardrooms. Yeah. How do you think about covering those stories that are about changes within this economy, culture?
Yeah, I love covering. I mean, those are my favorite stories to do, just because, like, I, like, I'm very theoretical, and I'll just, like, I like to, like, sit around and pontificate on things. So I feel like with those stories, though, I have, you can only do it if, one, it's really big and mainstream enough, or, like, pronounced enough. Like, with that shift away from this one aesthetic to another aesthetic, like, it's not just something I noticed. Like, it was kind of backed up by, like, a lot of different factors and numbers in terms of, like, account growth and stuff. And it was something that people in the industry were talking about so much, and I felt like nobody had really written the definitive piece on it. And so, you know, I felt like that would be valuable. With other trends, it really depends. Like, the smaller kind of YouTube things, like, there's, like, trends in YouTube thumbnails, for instance, that, like, I probably wouldn't write, like, hey, now everyone's doing this type of thumbnail now. But I might do, like, a larger look at, like, the importance of thumbnails and, like, kind of use that as a way to, like, talk about some of these changes. But it depends. I think you have to make it, like, a relevant enough story so that people have some bigger takeaway.
What do you look for in terms of quotes and evidence for something like that? Like, what do you look at as the source material that you build these arguments
out of? I mean, with that one, it was, like, very clear. I mean, the good news about covering stuff like that is that you can see these trends play out in metrics. So it's like, okay, these influencers that are adopting this different aesthetic and different photography techniques and palette and stuff, like, their account growth is outpacing, you know, these other people that have stagnated. So that was easy. Also, just, like, it's something that a lot of people, like, internally, like you were talking about, marketers have thought about and were collecting data on. And you could see it sort of economically in the struggling way that some of these, like, Instagram museum type of, like, photography places had been struggling. There was a lot not in that article that got cut. Shout out to my editor for making it better. But, you know, I had interviewed a bunch of people that had had photo installations and nobody was really interested in taking pictures at them anymore. I talked to a couple music festivals on how they had phased out a lot of the traditional Instagram stuff. So I feel like I talked to so many people to validate stuff and make sure it's widespread enough. I would say the other thing I look at is, like, memes around it, because I think, like, it's easy to find, like, 20 or 30 people that will tell you something's a trend, but, like, the way to know if it really is, like, if there's, like, meta commentary around it, I guess. So I usually look for that, too. Like, if I'm going to write about something, it has to be real enough that people are, like, talking about it.
I think one of the biggest challenges of reporting on the social era has been metrics themselves. Like, what number is a video going viral? Like, you know, you'll see some, like, up and coming artist, like a pop artist, and they'll be like, his video went viral, 200,000 views. You're like, 200,000 views? This is nothing.
I think about that because, like, I think about that when I talk about my Tumblrs, because I'm like, I remember being like, oh, yeah, like, I'm hot shit. I have all these viral Tumblrs. And I'm pretty sure they had, like, I don't remember, but, like, 1,000 or 5,000 or, you know, 10,000. And it's like, now you would laugh at that.
Well, and you can see, like, if you are a, you know, a new musical artist in your region and have not broken out nationally and you have a video that gets a million views, that is, like, momentous for you. However, you also cover people like real YouTube stars to who if they ever put out a 1 million view video, they would like retire, you know, like, well, yeah. I guess 1 million is always like pretty, is pretty good. But you're talking about people who have over a million subscribers and have put out hundreds of videos that each have 1 million views. So how do you think about metrics? How do you write about metrics? How do you not get like sucked into the like exact moment where these things are going up and down, what they mean?
It depends on who you're writing about. And like, I mean, I think that you just have to be authentic. Like, I think that like why some of that other stuff is cringy is because it's like, it's disingenuous. It's like you're just trying to make this person seem like a bigger deal than they are so you can validate your article. Like, but it's like you don't always need metrics to have impact. Like, there are people that are like very creative and groundbreaking or doing something interesting and emergent that like maybe they don't have all the followers yet, but they're doing something that's indicative of something bigger, or they're breaking a norm in some way, or they're interesting in some way. So it's like, I mean, I definitely don't subscribe to the idea of like, oh, you only cover the biggest people, or those are the only... I mean, ContraPoints is a good example of this trans YouTuber, Natalie Nguyen, that's like done amazing work and is constantly being written about and stuff. And I don't think she has that many... I mean, she has a couple hundred thousand subscribers, but it doesn't mean that it's not impacting culture or norms. And like, so I think like it's just important when you're reporting on this stuff to put it in context.
So how do you wade through this whole world? Like, what is your information diet like? Do you have like a... this is what I like myself, but this is what I look into for work.
No, there's no barrier between my work and life, which is not so healthy. I know that's going to have to eventually change.
Yeah.
It's not sustainable. I mean, I think it's fine for now, but like I have a couple friends that have kids and I'm like, okay, I guess there's times when you really can't do that. But yeah, I mean, I just spend a lot of time like looking around at stuff. I spend so much time on Instagram. I kind of just talk to a lot of people online. There's no like one set thing. Like I go wake up every morning and do this, this, this. It's more like I just kind of try to like absorb as much as possible from everywhere and then think like of interesting things.
Are you behind the scenes as well? Like what you're describing of being on Instagram a lot is...
I mean, I have like 32 Instagram accounts. I set up accounts all the time just to lurk. I'm a big lurker.
Why so many accounts?
Because you have to tailor your audience. Like if you only have your one Instagram account, you're only getting that perspective. Instagram will serve you content related to what you're doing on that account. So you have to get out of your bubble. And so if I want to learn about the car world or something, I set up an Instagram account and start posting about cars, because that way algorithmically it'll start to feed you, you know, stuff related to that, or you can go into a different community or learn about adjacent communities. So it's just like a better way.
How do you manage all these different Instagram accounts?
Actually, one got banned recently, so it's like 31 now, I guess. I just like log in and out. You can only be logged in to 5 at a time. I have like my main account, like my main public account, and then like a personal account, and then like this TikTok aggregator account that I started. Those are like my main ones, and then the other two I just like log out and log in depending on the day, kind of like what I'm into.
Are people aware that these accounts are run by Atlantic journalist Taylor
Lorenz? No, because I don't really interact. What I do is like I have lots of accounts.
Yeah.
I just like lurk and then kind of determine like who's who in the community. And then if I want to talk to them, I follow them from my main, because my main is verified. So if I message them from some random like car account, they'll be like, whatever, this is some. But if I message them from my main that's verified, that says like journalist at the Atlantic, they'll respond.
So you contact them from.
Or they'll be like, fuck you and block me.
Assuming that they don't immediately block you, like what is your relationship with a 17-year-old influencer, like what do they think about a reporter asking about what they do?
Usually they're down to talk. I mean, it depends. It totally depends. Like, I mean, I'm in a lot of Discord communities too with a lot of like young people, and I'm always like, hey, I'm a reporter. I mean, sometimes I'm in a lot of group chats too with like people. I put a thing in my Instagram one time, like, add me to your group chat, and like all these people added me to their group chats, and I don't know. I kind of like to lurk. I want them to feel like comfortable enough with me, but like not too comfortable with me, because I want them to still like know that I'm a reporter, you know, and I'm not their friend.
Yep.
But I mean, most, I would say, quote unquote, influencers want, I mean, they want to talk about themselves because they want an audience. That's usually why they're online. So they're usually down. I would say what they don't like is being misrepresented in the press, which happens frequently. So I usually just have to kind of explain that, like, I'm not one of those reporters that's going to fuck them over.
On the other side of the coin, when you have to explain to an editor or someone hiring you, like, why this world is important to someone who knows nothing about it. Like, do you have a primer for, like, why what you're doing matters for someone who thinks it doesn't matter?
I mean, so many people think it doesn't matter, but it's changing. The past year has changed so much. The past year and a half. I would say, like, the Logan Paul video, the suicide video, when Logan Paul, who's a famous YouTuber, filmed and posted a video of this dead body in Japan of a man who had committed suicide. There was a huge backlash against that. That, it's so weird because Logan Paul has done so much bad stuff over the years that I was like, when I first saw that, I was like, oh, of course he would do this, like, whatever. And I don't know. I feel like for some reason that, like, broke through to a lot of people. And then, you know, more recently, there's just been a couple other dramas. So I feel like people have a greater awareness of who these people are and the audiences that they command. But there's not a lot of, like, thoughtful coverage.
It's interesting that you cite that as, like, a breaking point, because that is about when I started paying attention more closely to this world. And, you know, I was like, okay, well, who's the most popular? And I think, at least among the ones I sampled, like, I checked out PewDiePie. I checked out the, like, H3H3 productions. I guess that's who you would aim in my direction if you were aiming them. And I guess I was shocked a little bit how dark the world they occupy is. Like, I think part of assuming that this world is vapid is ignoring that it's, like, more like a bunch of people who are, like, locked in a basement, but are millionaires locked in a basement. And all they're doing is talking about each other, commenting on things that each other did in videos, commenting on comments.
There's so
things.
Much. It's crazy. Okay, can we, this is, like, something that I feel so strongly about. When people are like, there's no coverage of these people. It's like, there is endless coverage of these people.
The
it's,
people who are really famous just are the media. They cover people.
Right. Or
PewDiePie,
it's like
doesn't
drama
do
alert.
Anything.
It's, or Pew News, where he does a roundup. And, like, that's been, like, something that, because people will be like, well, where do I go to find information? I'm like, all they do is talk about themselves. They start drama with each other and make videos about it.
You know, like, one of the things that always, like, caught me is, like, there's a lot of finger wagging. It's more finger wagging than I thought. Because I was like, these are the people who we wag our fingers at. But all they're doing is wagging their fingers at each other, where it's like, Logan Paul does these gift box videos and it's a scam and it's like ripping Jake off Paul, children. Yeah. And then it's like, then that person is like shilling something else in a slightly more transparent way.
Yeah.
But it has that feeling of like a totally self-contained world. And I think that can be confusing to journalists, because journalists are used to this, like, well, there's real life that people lead. And then the journalists come in and tell you, like, what life is, and this is like life and journalism and commentary and beef. It's all in one. Everyone just wears all the hats.
Yeah. It's funny. Like, it's really different. I would say what there is a lot of in that world, I mean, especially I wrote about those tea accounts recently, which is like a big trend, is like the drama stuff.
What are tea accounts?
Oh, they're drama accounts. They're like like the Shade Room.
Oh, I love the
that
Shade
kind
Room.
Of thing. Okay, so there's like thousands of those.
So that's not, I would call that gossip.
Okay, so I would call tea accounts gossip accounts.
Gossip
and they
accounts.
Just post unverified news. But they all consider themselves journalists, kind of. So I don't want to, like, some of them do like very legitimate reporting on people.
Well, I mean, I think the Shade Room's incredible. It's like how I know about like half of the like celebrity stories.
Yeah.
But there is, I can see why you're like drawing a distinction between traditional gossip and them, because often they will say something on Instagram and then the person who's being referred to will respond on Instagram.
Yeah.
There'll be a news story. And it feels like this, like it's almost like if like every person CNN covered was in the CNN studio at all times and had their own show on CNN.
Yeah.
And it was like, Jake Tapper, fuck you.
Yeah. It's all like, they all respond to each other. I mean, I wrote a long profile of Keemstar, who runs Drama Alert, which is like a big YouTube channel that kind of also does this like daily news show of news related to influencers and YouTubers and stuff. And there's a lot of coverage of the drama of it. There's a lot of coverage of the scandals of it. what I think it misses is like putting it all in context in the broader society and like these bigger changes. And like, especially what we're talking about, like that drama part of YouTube is, I mean, everything on YouTube is drama, but like, I just think sometimes it's like misses a lot of the sub trends. And if you talk to these people about their work or lives, it's kind of like, that's what I like to get at. It's less the drama reporting. I mean, I love that stuff. I watch it all day. BuzzFeed just started a drama newsletter about influencers and I was like, subscribe.
I think I was always confused because I was like, oh, these are people who like lead double lives. Like they're like famous on the internet and they have a regular life. And I think that has become kind of an antiquated idea. Yeah. These are very full-time professions.
And like, they're very like relevant in today and they're shaping media today. So it's like, that's what media looks like. Like if you want to think about like how news is like consumed and proliferates and stuff, it's those types of accounts. It's like the T account stuff. It's less like the Jake Tapper stuff.
So for you, like seeing media go in that direction, what's it like, you know, logging into the Atlantic CMS?
Should I start a YouTube channel?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm curious. Like you are covering the most cutting edge media from a legacy publication that is itself going through its own digital transformation. Now, how do you feel about like the format that you're covering it in?
It's like, cool. I mean, so the one thing that I would say is like, I never anticipated being a writer and I still don't think I'm like the best writer. I mean, even when I make an article, I got told by one of our editorial assistants to stop putting so many pictures in and stuff. Like my inclination is to just kind of like embed everything that I found and like make this whole thing. And
it's hard not to, because it's like what are you supposed to like do a quote with quote marks? It's a tweet,
it's,
you know,
it's exactly.
Like you can put the tweet in the story.
Yeah, it's like a lot of that stuff. I mean, I think also coming from working on like a social role, and I worked on a lot of like, I would say there was this trend around like distributed content. Like, let's make content for social media. So even writing an article is, I think, like, that's my biggest flaw. I'm not good at it in a lot of ways. But it's fine. I like it. I think it's also a great way to consume information. And people still read articles.
So I'm curious, because I think more people on the show are coming to this from being a writer and then are assigned to, say, cover something like technology.
Yeah.
You are coming from that world and you've, like, become a writer in that world. What have been the biggest challenges for you as a writer? And, you know, what have you learned about like turning this world into text?
Yeah. I mean, I got really good at like doing these like quick trending posts for Facebook. So I'd like see a tweet, write it up 200 words or something just to have a link to post about that on Facebook and get traffic that way, I guess. So I guess that got me like a little comfortable with writing. There was this editor, Cooper Fleischman. I don't know why I said was, because he's still alive. But there is this editor, Cooper Fleischman.
R.I.P. Cooper.
No, Cooper needs a death hoax. Cooper is the one that got me to start writing. So Cooper used to be at the Daily Dot and then he was at Mike.com, actual R.I.P. Anyway, he was like, you should write about some stuff. Like, he kind of encouraged me to write. So I wrote like a couple like guides for him, like a guide to do this thing on Twitter, like a guide to make these kind of emojis. And it just got me more comfortable with like, I was like, whoa, I could make an article. Like, that's crazy. But he let me freelance for him. So when I was doing social at The Hill, I also for a year freelanced for him at Mike as a contributor at Mike. And he let me cover whatever I want to. I always, to be honest, would have probably wanted to write more stories about the stuff that I cover, but there was no audience for it. Like 3 years ago, there was no audience for it.
When you're like working sources, are you talking to them on the phone? Are you chatting?
No. Every single person I talk to wants to do interview over DM, and I have a policy, no DM interviews.
Interesting. Tell me why.
First of all, it's a nightmare to transcribe. That's a huge part of it. But more importantly, you don't know anything. Like, you can't tell anything. I mean, I've done some interviews over Discord, which is a little bit better. And sometimes once you start chatting with them over text on Discord, you can be like, hey, can you just go to a voice channel? Because like you can voice chat really easily on Discord.
Yeah.
So I'll do that a lot.
And like, then you just like record the Discord voice channel.
Yeah. And I'm just like, hey, can we just like chat here? Because I want to be able to record it and just get your quotes right. But like no 14-year-old memer wants to get on the telephone ever. And you have to coax them into it.
Do you think people talk differently when they're using their voice instead of their fingers?
Yes. Yeah. And you can really understand tone, and you can hear like how old people, you know, how old they really sound. And they also just the stuff that they talk, you know, when it's person to person, it's like they kind of understand you a little bit more too. It's like, you're not just some faceless person on the internet. I think they tell you way more. I mean, they don't really tell you much over text and DM and stuff. It's like you really have to. I mean, some people do, but you just want to get them on the phone. I have a no DM interview policy. And I miss stories because of that. There's stories that I've not gotten because I refuse to do DM interviews.
Do you find that it like snaps them out of the persona that they exist in within their fingers? I mean, I guess that's in some ways a good and a bad thing. It's a good thing in that you're discovering something new, but you're also taking them out of their native environment.
But you want them to be out of their native environment. Like, you're trying to talk to the person behind these accounts, or like the person, you want to get to know these people and you want to understand them and like their motivations and the way they talk. And, you know, there's all these like subtleties that you miss when it's, you're giving them time to respond to it. Like, you can't clarify mid question, you can't hear somebody trail off. Like, it's really hard and it's almost impossible to do. So I feel so strongly about that.
Do you find that you reach points in these interviews where you encounter a digital artifact or a digital event that's difficult to talk about interpersonally with someone? Like, I imagine if you're like, hey, so why did you post that meme? Or like, why did you make this Tumblr? You know, it's something that someone might have never verbalized before.
I was going to say the one thing that's hard is a lot of people, I mean, can't put their work in context. Just the way that it's hard for me to even put my own work in context, it's like hard to think out of yourself, you know what I mean? And so, yeah, like sometimes I'll be like, why did you start this meme account? And they'll say something about it, why they did. But it's like, really, it has to do with some other bigger motivation or bigger trend or something. Or it's hard. I mean, that's true for any interview, but I think you get more out of it and more thoughtfulness when you have them on the phone than over DM, where they're just going to be like, I don't know.
You said that there was no separation between like the you who's looking into this stuff and the normal you, the not at work you. Is that like hard? Like, is it difficult immersing yourself so much and having an identity that's professional in this and also a personal identity? Do you feel like a need to carve out any space for yourself?
I don't have a personal identity. This is my personal identity. I mean, I think once I dove like headfirst into Tumblr, like, I kind of just, that this is my life. Like, this has just been me, like, on and off. Like, I don't know. I've always been like that, where it's like when I'm so into something, I need it to be my life, because otherwise I can't have that thing where it's like, oh, I just go to my job from 9 to 6 and then I turn it off after work. It's like, I'm obsessed with this. Like, this is all I want to do. It's all I want to cover. I want to be the best at it. So it's something I think about 24/7.
Well, I think that the only pre-internet niche I can remember that people felt this way about is sports, actually, where there's like, you know, people who are like guys who do morning drive time radio. You don't get the feeling like, wow, if they didn't have this show, they wouldn't watch the NFL.
Yeah.
Just, you know, all of my Sunday, it's just a work thing. No, there's no one who succeeds in sports media who would not otherwise just be watching sports all the time and creating an identity based around sports. But I'm wondering, unlike sports, which I think are just kind of, they're always there. They change a little bit, but like the NFL of today is not that different than when I was a kid. The ground under you is changing so rapidly. I mean, some stories that you've written that I was looking at that are 2 years old, I'm like, ah, simpler times. how do you deal with the pace? And does it mean that you can't like invest longer and amounts of times in a specific story because the terrain changes so quickly?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's like all these human stories that you can do that could be longer. I mean, I'm not a very good long form writer because I have no experience with that. It's really hard for me to write a story that's long. Like, I don't like it. I like to do news stories that are quick because I'm also impatient and something happens and I want to write about it. So it's hard to like, but there definitely are, you know, longer arcs or like things. Like, I wrote this story for New York Mag a while ago on this YouTuber that quit the internet. He was like, he went to VidCon, which is this annual YouTube conference thing, was like, I want to be a YouTube star, became a YouTube star, and then had like a mental breakdown and quit everything. And like, I think my story was like 2,000 words, but that kid, like, you could write a long thing on it.
I mean, there's an operatic element to some of this stuff where there are these people who are given unprecedented amounts of attention and often money at a very young age, but are totally insecure, both personally, but also like their status and their fame and their wealth is also very insecure. The puck moves away from Vine. Is it clear that they're going to be a star on some other platform? Yeah. No, like everyone's almost about to have the rug pulled out from under them at all times. And to me, that's sort of what makes it all like tragic, or what gives it all this kind of air of like, I rarely read about one of the people who populate their stories and think, wow, I'd like to change places with them, or like, if only I was a YouTube star. I like, mean, it's not very glamorous.
No, it's so much work. I mean, it's so much work. I mean, it's grueling. Like, that's why the entire theme of last year was burnout. I mean, that's what every YouTuber was talking about. And we saw a lot of top YouTubers burn out. I mean, being an influencer in general is grueling, backbreaking work. And then, you know, you're constantly getting, it's terrible. You have no protections. It's a completely unregulated industry. You're getting exploited by brands. You're getting, you know, shit on by the media. You're getting, it's just, it's really hard. So I never want to trade places. But yeah, I guess, I mean, there are like longer stories that I probably could write. Sometimes I'll write like a little bit longer of a thing, like if it's like an investigation type thing.
So much of what has come to represent like tech journalism now, I feel like in the last couple of years has become about like, is this bad? This is bad, right? or good, actually. Like you could also say other areas where it's like, we're just trying to change the world and help people. Like it's all of these narratives of good versus bad. And I think that the stuff you're covering occupies like a grayer area.
Yeah, I don't want anyone to come away from my stories thinking like this is really good or this is really bad. I mean, one thing I feel strongly about technology, and I am more of an optimist than a lot of other people that cover technology, just in the sense that like it's more like ambiguous, I would say. And it's more like this is the world that we live in now. And here are pros and here are cons. There's a lot of cons, but there's also these pros. And I don't know, you were talking about like how things change and shift under me. Like I like that. I like to like constantly see how things are evolving and new. And tech journalism is weird because I think so often it's usually dedicated to covering like the corporate side of it or like the regulatory aspects of it. And I always cover things from the user side.
Yeah. What excites you going forward? Where are your interests going and where can you take this writing project that you're now pretty deep into?
Oh, I know. I mean, thinking about how technology affects people's ability to communicate and connect is like my biggest life's passion. Like, I feel like I discovered something that is just, I'm obsessed with it and I can't get enough of it. And maybe I'll max out in a few years and quit and do something else. But I feel like I just want to keep writing or working in this space.
As you've become, like, to me, you're the expert in this field. Maybe there's other experts out there. You're the only one that I know about. Do these YouTuber stars know who you are?
Yeah.
Are you're so, like, I guess my question would be, like, if you get too famous doing this stuff, will you still be able to have the same access? Or will people know, like, oh, if you appear in a Taylor Lorenz story, you know?
No. Well, first of all, they don't like to give press access unless they write some glowing bullshit thing on them. So, you know, it's not like that's changed anytime recently. I would say a lot of them know who I am because I covered it before anyone else. Like, I mean, this beat, it's crazy because I made this beat off my interests and I feel like I got into the world really early. And so I think there's a lot of people that I've known for years. I mean, since like we met basically when I was really online and I just like met a lot of people and, you know, a lot of people that were smaller on YouTube blew up and I know them still. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not to say that, I mean, I know them in a work context. Like, it's not like I'm not a YouTuber myself. I'm not an influencer myself. I don't really care to be like that. You know, I'm not trying to like get in front of the camera all the time. Although I like do TV hits and stuff, but I'm not going to be a creator.
What is it like when you do those like TV hits and they're like want like 30 seconds on this topic?
So stupid. I actually decided a couple weeks ago that, or like 2 months ago, that I'm not going to do it anymore. I had this stint where I was like, I mean, I feel this past year and a half has changed so much, Aaron. Like people would never respond to my stories before. Like, people would never book me on an interview. People would never even pay attention to what I was writing. And when I was writing, like, some of my best work, which was for Mike, when I was just freelancing for Cooper, like, people just didn't care. And because it wasn't really in the public consciousness yet.
Yeah.
And in the past year, it really has become. And so it kind of scared me because I felt like, shit, like, everyone suddenly knows about this. Like, I need to be the best. And if I'm not the best, like, someone else is going to be known as the best. And so it's like, I feel like I have to say yes to every podcast. You know, I'm happy to be on this one. And I have to say yes to, like, you know, every Cheddar interview, or like, someone else will take my place. And I'm trying to chill out about that.
Do you see what's going on and see, okay, this is where it's going, I think it's going to be here in 2 years? Or are you, like, as in the dark
two
as
years.
Anyone else? Or
oh my God.
6 months?
I know.
How far ahead of yourself do you see?
People always ask me, like, oh, what's the new Facebook or whatever? Yeah. I don't know. I kind of, like, have my own theories about stuff, but I usually just like to, like, see how it all happens. I'm not, like, some, like, savant that, like, knows where things are going. I would say it's just, like, a lot of times you'll see all these big shifts, like with the Instagram aesthetic. It's like all these shifts are happening, and until someone articulates them, nobody really notices them. I mean, that's what makes the best, like, culture and trend reporting too. It's like all of this stuff is happening and you need someone to, like, give it a name or, like, tell you, like, you know, whatever. So with technology, I mean, I think it's just, like, integrated into everything now. I don't know that there's there's this idea that a lot of VCs believe in, which is probably true, that people are moving into small closed communities. And I see that with things like Discord and stuff and group chats. But
is that going to make it harder to do your job because you can't just spy on people all the time?
No, I just join all the group chats. No, I don't know. I mean, I think, like, it's always going to be some kind of scale. Like, Facebook groups, for instance, is a good example. Like, you can still do amazing reporting on Facebook groups. You just join the groups.
Right.
But you do have to go out and find those communities more.
And sure. You have to, when you join a group, like, you have to be like, hey, journalist here.
Yeah.
Entering the room.
No, I'm always like, hey, don't throw me out. I'm just here to lurk or, like, learn or whatever. I always email an ad, or I always DM the admin, though, before I join a group. Because I always want the admin to know that I'm, like, not trying to just, like, go in there and, like, fuck with everyone or
I am not them. A narc.
Yeah. Well, also because they'll just deny you or not accept you. But, I mean, I feel like she's going to think I'm a creepo stalker. But Katie Natopoulos at BuzzFeed is someone I've always looked up to. And, like, one thing I love about her reporting is, like, she's not judgmental about anything. Like, even when you can tell, like, it's, like, cringy and stupid and, like, obviously everyone's judging something, like, she's just, like, very good at being like, this is what this is. And so, like, I think of that so much. I mean, it's funny because I was making fun of moms recently, being like, moms are so stupid, or, like, playing into that stereotype of, like, moms being dumb. And, like, she did some tweet. I think it was around the Momo challenge of all the moms sharing this Momo hoax. Anyway, and she said something on Twitter about, like, that's, like, stupid, and, like, she's a mom also. And I was just, like, thinking, like, oh my God, this is, like, what people say. Like, this is how people talk about influencers, and I hate it. And I hate when anyone just, like, writes a group off or is condescending. So with my reporting, I try to, like, not be that way.
Thank you so much, Taylor.
Sorry, thanks for listening to my rant.
No,
I'm like,
great.
Oh, take the mom seriously. But thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And that was the Long Form podcast. Thanks to Taylor Lorenz. Thanks to our editor, Janelle Pfeiffer. Thanks to our intern, Louisa Garbowit. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. And of course, the incredible people who make this show possible, MailChimp and Pit Writers. Thanks to them. If you'd like to get in touch, podcast@longform.org. If you're enjoying the show, maybe rate it on iTunes, leave a comment. It helps new people find the show. Yes, I know we've done hundreds and hundreds of episodes, but there are still people who do not know about this show. So tell a friend. We appreciate it. We'll see you next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.